Hey everybody, I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway. The Metropolitan Museum of Art announced last week that it would stop accepting gifts from the Sackler family, who are behind Purdue Pharma and the drug OxyContin. Many have argued that the Sacklers have played a major role in the nation's opioid crisis, and they're just the latest example of big-dollar museum donors having their business connections scrutinized in the context of social justice. The Whitney Museum has also faced protests over its connection to Warren B. Kanders, who sits on their board of trustees. Kanders' company, Safariland, provided tear gas canisters used on migrants at the southern border. That connection led one artist to pull out entirely from the Whitney Biennial, one of the art world's premier events. Michael Rakowitz, an Iraqi-American visual artist based in Chicago, spoke to me about his decision and the role that donors like Kanders play in the arts.
It's true that the current ecosystem is dependent on these big donations, but I don't think that that means that we can't envision something that's more ethical, as something that actually puts pressure in a lot of different directions, not just the institution and the work that gets shown in it, but the way that people actually do make decisions about what they bring into the world and the way in which fortunes are built. I don't think that that's outside the discussion. And I think that that's something that when it comes to the work that I do that deals with militarism, that deals with the devastation and the aftermath of war, that deals with displacement and the pains and the traumas that are wrapped up in it, there's no way that I could justify accepting funding and permission from one of the structures that contributes to that very thing being perpetuated. So for me, these loops that we participate in, where we're actually feeding the monsters that we apparently care about dismantling, it just doesn't make sense. And so I do think that it's going to be difficult. I do think that institutions are going to be different if we are going to follow this line down to the potential evolution, which may mean smaller institutions, which may mean, you know, none of the expansions that we're seeing now, which may mean not like hiring starchitects to build these huge monoliths, and it may mean less blockbuster shows. But I don't know that that's necessarily a bad thing. You know, for me, that seems like a more responsible way of operating in the world, not just in the world of art. You know, so for me, it's not just something that's specific to the art world. I think it has a lot to do with the way in which we see this field of industry and other forms of capital.
I think in terms of what you just said, I think there are artists who might find it maybe not easier, but have more ability to say no to the Whitney or to the Guggenheim. And then there are artists who've been toiling away for whom having their work in one of these institutions is the ultimate in terms of recognition. Is that okay? I mean, what about artists who can't say no?
I think that that's fine. And I did not ever, you know, ask for anybody else to do what I did. In fact, the decision that I made was private. It was a decision that I conveyed to the two curators, and I conveyed this to Adam Weinberg, that you would not compromise the integrity of a work on paper by showing it in unsafe conditions where the relative humidity is wrong or the temperature is wrong. Why would you compromise the integrity of an artist and ask them to show with the permission and the funding coming from somebody who makes conditions unsafe for others? However, I do agree with you that I'm in a position where I could say no, but that was one of the reasons why I had wanted to keep my decision completely private, to make sure that my fellow artists did not feel pressured to do something that they weren't capable of doing. But my decision was leaked, and now it is a public conversation, so I'm just one part of it.
How can artists be supported if not through these large institutions, if not through big money? Can artists actually avoid ethically dubious benefactors?
You know, one thing that's for sure is that these boards are public knowledge. This is not necessarily news, and it's not stuff that is completely invisible. But I don't think that it was necessarily visible in the way that it's become visible now. In science, they say if you want to know how a system works, you introduce a coloring agent. And in a way, those tear gas canisters became a form. They became a very visual moment of illustration where one could not just plead ignorance. it was very visible. And the irony of those tear gas canisters appearing at the same time that the Campbell soup cans by Warhol are being shown with the support of Canders, you know, I'll never look at those soup cans the same way. So in that sense, visibility in this respect is a good thing, because it allows for us to look closer at these relationships that may have been a little less visible, and it becomes an ethical question. How can artists be supported outside of these big industries or these big money structures? It's a good question. I mean, my day job is teaching at an institution that's its own problem. You know, teaching at Northwestern University doesn't, you know, I'm completely entangled in the same kinds of systems, you know, but I also have allies there who are looking to divest from harmful benefactors, from the influence of the military-industrial complex on the college campus. But we do get to make choices in certain places. And I don't think that we should be entrapped and think that we can't start to do that because we're just so deeply entangled.
We're coming up on the end of the segment, but I want to add one question, pivoting just a little bit here, sort of about the broader implications and how we look and value art, particularly after the burning of Notre Dame. We saw an influx, to say the least, you know, millions of dollars being pledged from people all over the world because they wanted to restore this landmark. And of course, one can understand that, except we don't see similar rushes to restore other art and artifacts, particularly those that are not Western European. And I'm thinking of the Museum of Colonial Art in Brazil. I'm wondering if you can comment on that.
I mean, I think that what's suggested in that question is, you know, it's very obvious. I mean, I think that there's an attitude that's afforded the West that is not afforded to the global South or for West Asia or the Middle East and places that have always had their artifacts extracted from, and the care has not gone into the cultivation of the people that live alongside those antiquities and those artifacts. And so I do think that it's one of the things that is very important in these conversations about decolonizing. And it's one of the things that I've been grappling with in my own work about Iraq and the cultural heritage sites that have been devastated after the war. And it's not as though this all falls so easily under the illustration that the West loves, that these places are being destroyed because they're un-Islamic. They're also destroyed because it's the one thing that has always been afforded importance by the West. And those disparities that you point to, I think, are part of a bigger problem that encompasses a lot of attitudes that the West has had towards the other.
Michael Rakowitz is a Chicago-based Iraqi-American visual artist. Michael, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.